Hi, I'm Ruth. I'm a grad student at UBC studying geophysics at the Department of Earth, Ocean and Atmospheric Science.
And I'm Margot. I'm also a grad student at UBC studying climate change at the Department of Geography. Today, we're recording this podcast as an outreach piece for our class on the most recent IPCC report. If you don't know what IPCC is, it stands for Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is an expert group consisting of climate scientists appointed by each country. It provides governments with scientific assessments on climate change, its history, implications, and potential future risks. The IPCC also proposes climate change adaptation and mitigation options. Many are familiar with the concepts of sea level rise and warming of our oceans. Increased heat content in the oceans is very concerning because it harms marine ecosystem, it reduces the ocean's capacity to absorb carbon from the atmosphere, it intensifies hurricanes and leads to an increase in sea levels. Increasing the sea levels, in turn, adversely affects coastal ecosystem, hence jeopardizing livelihoods, increasing the magnitudes of coastal floods, and forcing people to migrate away from the coast. But these changes are not exactly unprecedented, right, Ruth?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So it's important to note that the heat content and ocean levels have fluctuated throughout history, and even by far exceeded the current levels. But the difference between those events and current time is how quickly these changes have occurred, and the main drivers of these changes. Today we are going to delve into how we determine ocean heat content and sea level rise in the past and present, and how we know that the changes that we have seen in the last 70 years are as a result of human activity. When we are talking about the time in the past, we use two terms, instrumental and historic time. Instrumental time is defined as the time since we started to take measurements using instruments, and historical time is defined as the time before that. It can be difficult to determine what the past climate looked like since we rely on clues or proxies from the past to infer the amount of heat in the ocean. These proxies can be physical, chemical, or biological materials that were preserved in the geological record, and these can be analysed and correlated with climate patterns to help us understand what the past ocean heat content or sea level was.
It's so cool how different areas of science are used trying to figure out how Earth looked like in the past. Maybe let's delve into more detail on the specific methods used to determine ocean heat content. Ruth, could you explain what ocean heat content actually is, and how do we know that it has changed?
Yeah, I agree. It's really cool that all areas of science are used when looking at past and current climate. The ocean heat content is the energy that has been absorbed by the ocean, and it is stored as internal or heat energy. Scientists use different methods to investigate how the heat content of the ocean has changed over time. When looking at past heat content, ice cores and sediment cores are commonly used. So, when we're thinking about ice cores, when oceans warm, krypton and xenon are released into the atmosphere in known quantities. These gases are trapped as bubbles in ice, and scientists make ice core samples and melt them down to investigate the ratios of particular elements within the bubbles. Since the ratio of gases is related to temperature, we can infer what temperature the ocean was in the past. Another method used is sediment cores. When looking at sediment cores, we are interested in the evidence of biological material from the past. Here, microscopic marine organisms such as foramen ferra are used. These are single-celled organisms with shells. These animals take in oxygen from the seawater to make their carbonate shells. Two types of oxygen are looked at, oxygen-16 and oxygen-18. Oxygen-18 is an isotope of oxygen that has two extra neutrons and is therefore heavier. The ratio of oxygen-16 to oxygen-18 in the water is higher in cooler climates, and therefore, if the historic ratio in the remains of foramen ferra is high, we can say that the past ocean was cool, and if it's low, we can say that the past ocean was warmer. So, using both ice cores and sediment cores, we can say how much heat was in the ocean in the past.
Cool! But what about most recent times? Do we also use ice cores?
We generally don't use cores for recent times because we have more accurate measurements. So when it comes to the instrumental era, there are two main methods used to find heat content: direct estimates and indirect measurements. Examples of direct measurements include the Argo Array, conductive temperature death instruments, and devices on mammals.
Devices on mammals?
Yeah, we put devices on mammals like seals to measure the temperature in areas which are harder for humans and other autonomous instruments to go. This was stopped though in 2006 due to ethical concerns, but it worked on the premise of sound travelling faster in warmer water, and therefore acoustic pulses were sent from across the ocean, and the time taken for them to return to the seal was used to find temperature. Now, measurements from ships such as conductive temperature depth instruments can be very useful, but they are more expensive. The issue with ship measurements, however, is that there are often spatial biases, which means that areas of heavy trade are oversampled. And there's also temporal biases, where areas in higher latitudes aren't measured as often, especially in the winter, due to harsh conditions when it's difficult for people to be there. The Argo Array avoids this and ethical concerns that we get with seals. It's an experiment that has been running since 2006, consisting of 4,000 autonomous floats, which measure the temperature profile vertically to 2,000 metres, in the ocean once every 10 days. This is defined as the upper half of the ocean and is sufficient to look beyond seasonal temperatures and salinity cycles. Here, longer trends in ocean heating can be observed.
So, based on all these matters that you just described, what do we actually know about ocean heat content?
Yeah, so historically, the amount of heat has changed in the ocean over time. But as with most changes, and as I already mentioned, these are much quicker in the last 70 or so years. We know that the Earth has been getting warmer during this time, but what is very worrying for marine life and the overall health of the oceans is that 90% of the heat has been absorbed by the oceans. They are acting as a major heat sink for the world, and this is affecting how currents in the ocean move and wildlife which call the oceans home. There are three reasons why this dramatic heating has occurred. Number one, water has a higher heat capacity than air and therefore can store more heat. Number two, the ocean has a very large volume, which over 70% of the Earth's surface is covered by ocean. And three, the ocean is able to transfer heat from the surface to the deep ocean. And this cycle allows it to absorb heat from the top and send it to the bottom, making room for more heat absorption, and so on. So when looking at how ocean heat content has changed over the years, we focus mainly on the first 2,000 metres of the ocean. This is because most of the heat changes in the ocean over time are observed in this part, and it's also difficult to measure heat content below. Our overall confidence in measurements have increased as well due to our better understanding of global energy budgets and more accurate instrumentation. We are virtually certain that the upper 700 metres of the ocean have warmed since 1850, and that it's very likely that the 2,000 to 700 metre layers have also warmed. What is alarming is that the rate of warming from 1993 to 2017 has doubled that of 1969 to 1992.
Okay, so we know that it has warmed, but how do we know that these changes are due to human actions?
To answer that question, we need to think about what causes heating in the first place. So what I've talked about so far is how we know that how much heat was in the ocean before, how much heat is in it now, and how the heat gets there. There are two main ways in which heat can enter the ocean: natural occurrences and anthropogenic or human effects. Natural occurrences include volcanic activity and solar irradiance. Human-related occurrences include greenhouse gas forcing and the overall Earth heat energy budget of Earth. When attributing effects of certain processes on climate change, attribution studies are conducted. Here, a specific component, such as greenhouse gases or aerosols, are looked at individually or together. Reanalysis models take data from lots of different studies and use them together to get a better overall picture of the climate. Reanalysis methods can be used to help us get a full picture of what the climate was like in the past by combining measurements from then and now. The CMIP, or Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, is an example of such. It collects data outputs from the global ocean atmosphere models and combines them to get a better understanding of both heat and sea level over time. It combines these observations into a dynamically consistent estimate of the ocean heat content and change, and can potentially provide greater physical insight into the mechanisms of ocean heat change. It detects anthropogenic effects in the climate records of the past century and can also produce future climate changes due to human production of greenhouse gases and aerosols. It was particularly useful for determining trends that we had before the Argo Array, since it synthesizes a large amount of observations. For these models, experiments are run where the ocean heat content is influenced by natural and human causes. Pre-industrial, in other words pre-1850s, runs are used to estimate climate variability without anthropogenic forcing. Then, non-CMIP factors are accounted for. Finally, these models are compared to observed changes. We can then compare what the changes looked like with and without human effects to confidently say how much heat content of the ocean has changed. So understanding these findings can help us explain sea level rise too, right, Margot?
Yes, definitely. These findings that you have just talked about are very concerning because increased ocean heat leads to the expansion of water in the ocean, which is one of the primary drivers of sea level rise. Similarly to the ocean heat content changes, sea levels have been fluctuating throughout Earth's history, and there were times in the past where the sea levels were well above the current levels. but the rate of sea level rise that we observe now has been unprecedented in at least past 3 millennia. And the primary drivers of it are melting glaciers and the thermal expansion of water due to increasing ocean heat that you have just talked about.
So when you're talking about sea levels, do you mean global or local sea levels?
That is a great question. Yes, I mean global sea levels. It's important to differentiate between local or relative sea levels and global or absolute sea levels. Local sea levels at any point on Earth could be affected by vertical motion of the land, because land can be uplifted or can subside. And it can also be affected by winds, ocean circulation, or other processes. If we want to look at how the sea levels were changing throughout history, we're usually not concerned with local sea levels, but rather global. Global sea levels refer to the height of the ocean surface above the center of the Earth. They usually represent the average of the local sea levels. Global mean sea level is not affected by the processes that affect local sea level that I have just mentioned.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So when you mentioned that sea level changes have been ongoing throughout Earth's history, what do we know about some points in time when sea levels were above the current level? And can you tell me more about how we know this?
Definitely. So similarly to the way we determine ocean heat content, to find past sea levels, scientists usually use geological proxies. One example of such a proxy could be stellatherms. Stellatherms are cave features formed by the deposition of minerals, such as stalactites or stalagmites. Stellatherms are found in caves on the Spanish island of Mallorca, and what's important, they form at the water table. And the water table in these caves happen to coincide with the sea levels. Scientists have found stellatherms at different elevations in these caves. They used uranium-thorium dating to find the time when these stellatherms were formed, and they found that some dated back up to Quaternary, which is over 2.5 million years ago. So by looking at the elevation where these depositions were found, we can determine what the local sea levels were at the time. Another method that we can use to estimate past sea levels is to analyze coastal features. When the sea levels were significantly higher, marine fossil deposits were formed in the coastal areas that are now located well above the sea level. By dating the fossils and observing the shoreline, scientists can also determine what the local sea level was in this location. Another geological proxy that can help us to assess past sea levels are coral reef deposits. Corals only live in clear and well-oxygenated water in the first 50 meters of the sea column. As a result, coral reef deposits can provide information on the local sea levels at the time when they formed. Scientists record the elevation where they discovered coral deposits and used radiometric dating to find their age. This way, we can determine local sea levels at a specific time. Not only corals, but also fossiliferous deposits can be dated to determine past sea level elevation. In Bermuda and the Bahamas, scientists found marine deposits dating back to Marine Isotope Stage 11, which is the name of the interglacial period between 424,000 and 374,000 years ago. These deposits included fossils such as corals, fish, aquatic snails, and many other organisms, and even their burrows. These deposits were found at the elevation, which is over 20 meters above the current sea level, which suggests that the sea levels at the time were tremendously higher. Assuming that at the time local sea levels in this elevation was the same as the global, so it was over 20 meters higher than today, the West Atlantic ice sheet and the Greenland ice sheet would have to collapse completely, and the East Atlantic ice sheet, which is the most stable one, would need to melt significantly, unless there were changes in elevation in the region that affected the elevation at which these deposits were found.
Oh, okay, so for example, tectonic activity?
Yes, tectonic activity can cause changes in local elevation, but the thing is that both Bahamas and Bermuda are located in a tectonically stable region. For example, Bermuda sits atop a 40 million year old volcanic pedestal, so tectonic changes should not have caused changes in elevation of these regions.
So does that mean that the global sea levels were 20 meters at that time?
Not exactly. The elevation of the region can be affected by a process called a glacier isostatic adjustment, which is an adjustment of the Earth's crust because of the redistribution of ice mass. To put it simply, glaciers are extremely heavy and they push against the Earth's crust, causing it to deform or to subside. Meantime, the areas around the glacier, so-called periphery, experience an increase in elevation, so it's uplifted. When a glacier is melting and the pressure is removed from the land, the crust will try to reach its equilibrium state. You can think about it as a mattress. When you sit on top of it, it subsides underneath you, and when you stand up, it returns to its normal position. So the regions that were covered by the ice will be uplifted, so the elevation will rise when the pressure of ice is removed. Meanwhile, periphery regions that were uplifted before will subside, so the elevation would fall. We all know that when glaciers are melting, it adds water to the ocean, hence rising global sea levels. But the local changes in the sea levels can also be affected by this process that I've just described. So the areas that were previously covered by the glacier will be uplifted. As a result, the local sea level there will be slower. On the other hand, the periphery areas will subside, so the sea levels there will rise faster than global average.
So, do you suggest that the elevation of the deposits could have been affected by this process?
Exactly. Many of the sea level proxies, including the one in Bermuda, are found in places that were once located at the periphery of the glaciers. So during every interglacial period, they would subside. As a result, the local sea levels in this region would rise faster than average. So it's important to account for these processes when estimating global mean sea levels. Scientists have developed models for glacier as a static adjustment to model like these processes. These models help to calculate the actual global sea levels based on the different sea level proxies that can only give us information on local sea level. Glacier as a static adjustment models are usually based on the estimates of the extent of ice cover in space and in time, and on the model of internal structure of the Earth. Knowing Earth's internal structure is important because it helps us to determine how the crust would react to a certain pressure and how it would rebound when this pressure is removed.
Okay, so all sea level proxies need to be corrected for this glacial isostatic adjustment?
Most of them, yes. At least those that I have mentioned earlier. But there are proxies that are not affected by the glacial isostatic adjustment. Sea levels can also be reconstructed by looking at the oxygen isotopic ratio of deep water foraminifera. This is the same method as the one used to determine ocean heat content that you have already mentioned. The ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16 isotopes in the shells of these organisms can indicate rises in sea level. This is because oxygen 18 isotopes are influenced by global ice volume. And by knowing global ice volume, we can estimate how much water was in the ocean and what the global sea levels were. But the problem is that the ratio of oxygen 18 to oxygen 16 in these shells is not only a function of isotopic composition of water, but also the temperature of the water in which this organism developed. So we have to have independent indicators of temperature to find the concentration of oxygen 18 isotopes in the water at that time. This can be done by measuring the ratio of magnesium and calcium in the shells. As soon as we know the temperature, we can then estimate sea levels.
That's really impressive. But what about the instrumental era? How do we know about the most recent changes?
So when it comes to the instrumental era, there are two main ways to obtain sea level record: through tide gauges and satellite altimetry. A tide gauge is a device that records the height of the water level with respect to the local height reference. Because it relies on the local height reference, the record can be affected by vertical land motion, for example, due to ongoing glacial isostatic adjustment. This may change the elevation of the local height reference. To prevent incorrect results, gauge records are corrected using the Global Navigation Satellite System, which can detect vertical land motion. Another method used to determine sea levels is satellite altimetry. It measures the time taken for the radar pulse to travel from the satellite to the sea surface and back to the satellite. So it maps the topography of the Earth of the ocean surface. It is then compared to the modeled Earth's surface, so ellipsoid, and this allows us to determine the sea levels.
Oh, cool. But this can only give us local sea levels, right?
That's right. After the local records have been collected, and in the case of tide gauges, corrected for vertical land movement, statistical analysis is run to calculate the global mean from these local sea level data.
Okay, so based on all of these methods that you've talked about, what do we actually know about sea level rise?
So we know that throughout history, the sea levels have been fluctuating. For example, we know that with medium confidence that in the mid-Pliocene warm period, which occurred approximately 3.3 to 3 million years ago, the sea levels were about 5 to 25 meters higher. That's a very likely range. We also know that with medium confidence that during the mid-Holocene period, which is 6,000 years ago, the sea levels were 3.5 meters to 50 centimeters lower, and that's also a very likely range. That's just two examples of the low and high peaks of sea level. We also have a lot of data in between of these two observations showing fluctuations of sea level.
So how about the current sea level changes, and is there a significant rise right now?
Yes, we know with high confidence that global mean sea levels are rising, and the rate of their increase since 20th century is faster than over any preceding century in at least the last 3,000 years. Between 1909 and 2018, mean sea level rose entire 20 centimeters. We also know with high confidence that the rate of sea level rise is increasing. Between 1909 and 1990, the rate of increase was 1.3 millimeters per year. But between 1993 and 2018, it tripled to more than 3.2 millimeters per year. So there is a great consensus that sea levels are rising and the rate at which they are rising is accelerating. And these are very alarming findings.
Yeah, I agree. They're really alarming. So similarly for heat content, are we sure that humans are responsible for these changes, or could they have been natural?
Pretty much. You have previously gone over science behind the attribution studies that help us determine what factors caused ocean heat content. Similar attribution studies have also been conducted for sea level changes. From these studies, we know that climate models are only able to reproduce the observed trends of ocean heat content increase and sea level rise when anthropogenic, or so-called human-made emissions, are taken into account. In other words, according to these models, the current levels of ocean heat and current levels of sea could not have happened without human emissions. But it's important to mention that models that were run with only greenhouse gas emissions tend to overestimate the ocean heat content and sea level rise. This is because human-made aerosol emissions have a cooling effect on the climate. Hence, the observation of the ocean heat content and sea level changes can only be fully explained by including all human-made emissions, so both the greenhouse gases and the aerosols. As for the ocean heat content, as you have mentioned before, the models show that the observed heating of the upper 700 meters of the ocean since 1970 was very likely due to anthropogenic forcing. Similarly, the attribution studies focused on the sea level rise found that human-made emissions caused about 70% of the combined change in glaciers, ice sheet surface mass balance, and thermal expansion of the ocean that happened since 1970. These all factors are major factors that are causing sea levels to rise. So to conclude, we know that the main drivers of the observed increase in global mean sea levels and heating in the upper 700 meters of the ocean since 1970s, very like us humans.
Yeah, so thanks, Margot. I think we can both agree that these findings are really worrying, but I do think that it's good that we're living in a time with such a wealth of scientific knowledge and also understanding of the causes and effects of these changes. And most importantly, we know how to reduce and in some cases stop these changes, and we should start taking action now before it's too late. So thank you for listening to our podcast today. And if you want to know more about the changes in ocean heat content and sea level rise or other climate change impacts, you should refer to the latest IPCC report.